Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. When we think of the Industrial Revolution, we imagine giant factories packed with hard-working employees and dangerously efficient machines. Textile mills in New England are generally thought of as the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution, as British technology like the spinning jenny and spinning frame allowed yarn production to flourish. But those factories were preceded by smaller foundries and mills, and one researcher argues that a late 18th century flour mill located on the banks of the Patapsco River played a key role. Henry Sharp is an architectural historian and author of America's First Factory Town, The Industrial Revolution in Maryland's Patapsco River Valley. He'll be speaking at the Charles E. Miller Branch Library in Ellicott City on Monday, March 19th, an event organized by the Howard County Historical Society. Hal Sharp is on the line from his farm in Piedmont, Virginia, near Charlottesville. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
The mill was built by the Ellicott brothers, for whom Ellicott City is named. Tell us about the brothers.
Sure. The Ellicott brothers were from a Quaker family in southeastern Pennsylvania, and they had grown up in a wheat-growing culture that developed there in the late 17th and early 18th century. In my judgment, they were really remarkable systems engineers. They were industrious and interested in manufacturing processes, and they saw the immense growth of wheat cultivation and the growing markets that were occurring overseas, and they decided to move into the field of large-scale flour milling for the international market.
How many brothers were there involved?
There were five brothers altogether, though only four participated in the foundation of Ellicott City. But they were all involved in various degrees in flour production and flour milling production.
And it was in 1771 that they bought the land near Elk Ridge Landing, right?
Correct. They bought the property in 1771 and built an entire village, an entire industrial town from scratch. And they started by constructing a bridge, which is maybe not what you would expect, but they built a road and a bridge that made for an easy river crossing and provided, I should say, the traffic across that bridge really provided the lifeblood of the milling community. They envisioned connecting the growing territory of wheat cultivation going through western Maryland into Pennsylvania and down into the Great Valley of Virginia with the port at Baltimore Harbor, and linked those two critical sites with the water power available on the Patapsco at the site that became Ellicott's Mills.
I see what you mean about thinking like systems engineers.
The thing that, to me, really sets the Ellicott's off as remarkable innovators is that they not only saw that there was a growing market for wheat internationally and flour, but they envisioned the whole the process holistically and tried to craft a system that would encourage its development and growth as part of an industrial town.
Well, before the Ellicott Brothers flour mill opened, where did people in town get their grain, get flour?
The distinction here is that really from early on in American colonial history, there were small-scale flour mills, the classic country grist mill that we like to think of. And these were located all over the territory, wherever water power was sufficient to drive mill wheels or even tidal mills down on the coast. But these were generally small-scale operations, something that a person would take grain, wheat or corn to have ground for personal use. And the economic and agricultural wave that the Ellicotts were involved in was a much larger scale kind of process that catered to international markets. So large scale production and a consistency of production quality that couldn't be achieved in ordinary small scale mills.
So how much more flour was their mill producing than the smaller grist mills had?
Good question. And I'm afraid I don't have exact quantities, but their mill was begun in 1774, and it was the largest in the area. They took the standard type that was being developed in southeastern Pennsylvania in the 1750s and 60s and doubled its size. So they had a very, very large capacity. I can say that in the early 19th century, they insured their mill, that is the factory itself, and the flour and grain. And the flour and grain, the value of that commodity was four or five times greater than the value of the mill building itself, just to get an idea of the value of the produce generated.
You're painting a picture, it sounds to me, of a flour milling process that was fairly automated. How did the mill turn wheat into flour?
Yeah, so the automation did come very early to flour production. When the Ellicotts opened their mill, there were not automated processes. Wheat would have been harvested and threshed in the field to remove the grains from the stalk, and then further cleaned by winnowing. Then it was weighed and then ground by the grindstones in the mill, and then shifted up to a mechanism called a bolter, which would basically sift the raw ground grain. The flour would fall through a fabric net that would have either finer or looser weave that then their object was to produce what they call superfine white flour, our classic white flour. And the coarser elements left, the wheat bran, what we would call whole wheat or wheat germ, were not desirable because they didn't last as long and would tend to go rancid. So it was only the grinding that was automated. Fairly early on, in about 1790, a man named Oliver Evans patents some power-driven equipment that enabled grain and flour to be moved through a mill automatically. That is, horizontally or vertically through an elevator conveyor belt. And then finally, a mechanism called the hopper boy, named after a young man who would have spread out the freshly ground flour in the attic of the mill so it would cool off and dry before it would be packaged up. And so these parts of the process were automated in the 1790s, and the Ellicotts adopted them very quickly. So the flour mill, the large-scale merchant flour mill, was never source of as huge a number of employees as the textile mills of New England since automation took place quite early.
So about how many people work there?
When the Ellicotts first opened up, again, 1774, 1775, about 18 people, in addition to members of the family. So we can say probably close to 25 or 30. And that number remained pretty constant through the 18th century. There were, however, more people in the town because, of course, the production of flour was not the only activity which took place. The Ellicotts organized a sawmill, a leather tannery. They had wheelwrights shops, those people who would make wagons. They had cooper shops, the people who would make barrels that the flour would be shipped in. They had teamsters who would drive wagons. They had a company store. They had a tavern, a school, a church in the form of a Quaker meeting house, in addition to housing for the for all of the people in the community. Again, as I say, they kind of envisioned this community in a holistic way, not just as a flour mill, but as a much larger complex of family-run and contracted businesses that together promoted the flour mill and the economic health of the village altogether. That number, by let's say 1820 or so, about 300 people in the entire village.
That's architectural historian Hal Sharp, author of America's First Factory Town, The Industrial Revolution in Maryland's Patapsco River Valley. This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Sharp will speak Monday at the Charles E. Miller Branch Library in Ellicott City. You've mentioned that the Ellicotts were Quakers. What effect did their religion have on their business?
I think the Quaker worldview, let's say, did have a pretty strong impact on the Ellicott brothers in this sense. And the Quakers, as a religious community, held themselves apart from the dominant culture, both Catholic and Anglican. And in some sense, they were excluded from the major political roles that others could obtain. But they did excel in financial activities and commercial activities. And the Quaker worldview felt that demonstration of commercial success was in fact also a demonstration of their faith. So modest wealth, let's say, was something that Quakers aimed for. So they were removed from the world to a degree, but they were actually engaged in it in a very significant way in terms of commercial enterprise. And how this implicated the foundation of a milling community is that the Quaker brothers learned the value of a cohesive community toward that worked together toward the promotion of, you might say, divine community on earth. And in terms of the foundation of Ellicott's Mills, it helped them envision the holistic nature of the mill community.
You argue that the Ellicott's Mill, which was significantly smaller than the textile factories built slightly later, that it's part of the tipping point into the Industrial Revolution. Why?
Well, it struck me when I was beginning to do the research that what the Ellicotts had produced was a factory village before we began to think of factory villages, precisely because they had this holistic view of the economic and agricultural process. They didn't just build a mill, but they built a whole community that supported it. So in this sense, they created a mill town that had all of the attributes of the later mill towns that we come to think of as the originators of the factory type in America.
And you describe this mill as part of a larger economic transformation as the Mid-Atlantic moved from tobacco production to wheat production. Tell us about that.
Maryland, like Virginia, was founded as a tobacco colony. It's a significant part of the story in the sense that in terms of economic development, the tobacco economy was based on slave labor, and planters had contacts with international merchants, mostly English merchants and some French, to sell tobacco overseas, so that labor was not paid for, and the wealth from the commodity produced went to a small class of individuals who were owners and then shipped overseas. Wheat began to change things in a dramatic way because the market there opened up in Europe because of wars overseas and of periods of droughts. And the market opened up in the Caribbean because of the growth of sugar production culture there. And in addition, in the States, the Quaker population moving into Pennsylvania and western Maryland came from a community in Europe of grain producers. And so you have this nexus, if you will, of increasing demand in Europe, of individuals who are skilled in producing grain in the States, and really a vast quantity of land available for its use. Grain production took place mostly as a wage-based system. That is, the Quakers were, in general, they came to be a strong abolitionist, and the Ellicott's community was one that was founded on family-based labor, contracted independent contracted services, and then wages paid through the whole range of employees that were present. The fact of transferring grain into flour and into bread or into to be distilled into spirits or corn into meal required multiple steps, and those steps were undertaken in the colonies, in what became the States, as opposed to in Europe. So you have a great deal more production and economic activity, wage-based, that takes place in the colonies, and this really generates a significant move toward urbanization and economic development in the Mid-Atlantic.
What documents were you able to find to piece together your research on the Ellicott brothers and their mill town?
There are a variety of documents available. The Ellicotts themselves were rather laconic, so I don't have diaries or letters that detail their activities. But the most important documents for the Ellicott story are a series of ledgers that were kept in the mills It's these documents which detail all of the activities of the mills and from which I could infer their ideas about how the milling community was structured. In addition, there are public records, like real estate records, property tax records that detail their activities relative to purchasing property and the value and dates of buildings that were constructed there. There are newspaper stories that also give information about the history of the mills. And then finally, there are, let's say, iconographic records. So there's a very important early drawing done by one of the Ellicott sons, I should say the son of one of the original Ellicott City founders, who draws the original mill and some of the first buildings at the site. And then, of course, their later drawings and then into the era of photography, photographic and lithographic images of Ellicott City.
Is there anything left of the mill for people to see today?
I wish I could say there were. So the original mill, it burns in 1809. A new mill is constructed, and it lasts until the early 20th century. And the two tall structures there in Ellicott City now, operated by the Wilkins Rogers Companies, are the direct descendants of the original Ellicott Mill. But of the mill itself, we have no more specific remains. One of the original houses does survive, George Ellicott's house, and it dates from about 1790 and was moved out of its original location up the slope a little bit so that it was out of the floodplain. And there are a few other buildings right in the heart of Ellicott City that may have some of the original structures. The school and also the original Quaker Meeting House, which is now a residence, also survives.
Is there anything left of that original bridge?
Oh, no. The original bridge would have long since been washed out, but the bridge that crosses the Patapsco at Ellicott City is in exactly the same location.
Thanks so much for sharing your research with us. Thank you.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
Hal Sharp is an architectural historian and author of America's First Factory Town, The Industrial Revolution in Maryland's Patapsco River Valley. He'll be speaking Monday at the Charles E. Miller Branch Library in Ellicott City. And Hal Sharp will be back in town next fall on September 7th. We'll link to these events, which are presented by the Howard County Historical Society, at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Quick break now, and then a Stoop story. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.